Hello, this is Daryl War, and I am warning you, this podcast is going to be about the marriage novel Margaret Josette Dupré, chapters 1 through 5. So it is going to be marked explicit. And if you don't want to listen to something that your virgin ears may not like, then please turn it off. Yes, the novel Margaret Josette Dupré is a spin-off of The Pit of Ultimate Dark Shadows, which is not yet complete. However, it got a lot of support, a lot of pretty vocal support, back when I restarted it in 2014. This is for the second draft. I'm planning on creating a third draft. Perhaps I can get this out before or on Valentine's Day. I'm not sure I'm going to share it on a certain social network just because my emotional level, it's just not good there. I'm it almost never fails. Just getting angry or depressed or both and upset. So I don't know. I might ask Melissa to share it or Lisa, but it just depends on what everybody's schedule is. So hopefully you could just find it. Now, again, if you prefer the radio drama and you don't want the details of this novel, please turn it off. But I am going to try to do this 5 chapters at a time. And I worked really hard to try and make sure that each of the chapters wasn't too long for the sake that I knew attention spans were shrinking, and I wanted to try to make things easier, boost the talk of the readership back in 2014. I am still working on this novel, but I like to have some reliability in my life and maintain my focus on one thing at a time. And because this novel changed so much in my life and my husband's life, I find it extremely important. Plus, it was after, the inspiration was after that first intro for The Pit of Ultimate Dark Shadows, where I was asking what happiness is. You know, you get the down with the curtain and, what's behind the curtain? And I meant that for the radio drama, not this thing that happened. I am going over the reviews for chapter 1, and it was rough. It was rough and scary, and I was worried, and there's even an angry review by me, because I was so upset. But I didn't know what was going on. You know, I had an inkling, okay, people who like this canon pairing, this complicated canon pairing, have been denied access to each other. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. It's screwed up. And I felt like that's another reason I was like, well, I wasn't shooting for popularity anyway. I just wanted to find those people. Because I can understand, after however many years, when the only thing you have is either very expensive VHS cassettes or glimmerings of things that you watched on PBS that came and went and your schedule gets in the way and maybe there are accidents and all that kind of stuff. It's difficult to maintain the memory and the accuracy of a television show. There was no DVD technology. There was no instant streaming. So things happened, and with the enlightened idea of, this is okay because we know it's not canon. We're just kind of playing with this idea. But then other things came into being, and people start getting insecure and all that. So the new people who are introduced to the show, they see that pairing, what Barnabas Collins desires, who Josette is, very complicated. And then when they go looking for people to talk to about it, they're seeing just all of this stuff for the non-canon with Dark Shadows' name on it. And don't know what to do. So with my upbringing, I knew, okay, there's got to be some way of getting in touch with these people so that we can all just congregate. Like I said, you know, 25 people for the radio drama that maintained a casual connection with me and to it. And then 5 very strong, loyal supporters, or it could go back and forth. So it was just, this is what we see, let's get together, we have common interests, here we are. So it was just wonderful after I was so worried, and I had taken down the first draft, and a number of readers were very concerned. But that first draft, I mean, Helena and I have agreed, yeah, it was a mess. It was a mess. She did review some of it, but I was like, it's just such a mess. Like, chapter 3, what later became chapter 3, was on the end because it was coming at me differently, and there was other stuff where I was like, this is so complicated. But it just bit me very suddenly after I had started the podcast for The Pit of Ultimate Dark Shadows. I had to work with that, and I had the cold and all that, which you would hear from the intro to episode 6, I believe, or 7, probably, when I talked about having a cold, and that was why in episode 6, Roger had it when I did my performance for Roger in episode 6. For chapter 1 of Margaret Josette Dupré, the reviews are, I mean, they're wonderful. I had put chapter 1 initially in the T section, meaning PG, because I wanted people to be aware of it. The first chapter is very T-rated, and to let them know, if you want this, it's going to be going to the M-rated section. If you're aware of that, go ahead. Add your follower, whatever it is, which I don't mind follow so much for works of fiction, because that makes sense, you know, if you're building something. And thankfully, at least at fanfiction.net, no like buttons for a chapter. It's just you do it once and there you go. But yeah, it's just wonderful. The first chapter, I was looking over it, and I'm not sure there really needs to be much added to it. And it's Barnabas in first person. I had the wherewithal when I wrote this first chapter, because the first draft, it just started with the wedding night, and I didn't even call it the wedding night. It was just very sudden, explosive. So I realized when I restarted it, okay, let's get a wedding day out there. It made a lot of sense since Clue the movie is very much a part of The Pit of Ultimate Dark Shadows. Let's go back to that Mrs. White line of, life after death is as improbable as sex after marriage. Now, she used the word improbable, and that reminded me of the very famous Sherlock Holmes line, once you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. So I put those two together, saying that with those, I'd like to show that life after death and sex after marriage is both probable, plausible, and extraordinarily beyond that, wonderful. In fiction, of course, because some of this stuff, you know, stories, things that we really cherish, it's for a reason. They lift us up. Initially, I was just like, all right, what does Barnabas want to say? Just kind of ask his character and put him back into that first-person role. He is telling the story of most of this book. It goes back and forth, the perspective of view. He introduces us to, this is what I'm going through. This is how happy I am. I'm worried. Maggie's also worried. He kind of offends her at some point by being worried about calling her Josette. Then at some point refers to Josette in third person, and that makes Maggie real mad because she's been working hard to deal with all of these changes in herself, in her psyche, understanding what she wants as previously being Josette, also previously being Kitty, and also being herself, and saying straight up, what else did I have to look forward to in this life that could compare to what's going on right now? And, you know, Barnabas has been through so many hard times, just awful, awful things, including things that he can't forgive of himself. She has to continue to coax him through that. As Josette and Kitty, and knowing of those pasts, and knowing about the kidnapping, and realizing, okay, this wasn't the cruelty of somebody who wants to be cruel. This is the fragmentary behavior coming from this man who has been through so much that I know about. And also some of her spirit, her astral projection, is also going to understand that. That's incredible, but at the same time, I really was going through it and then read it to my husband, just going, okay, I think I can do this, that, and the other thing about, you know, changes, word choices, that kind of thing. But in essence, I didn't think I was doing anything spectacular. I just thought, well, this is how they would do things, and get to know the characters, and I've been working with them for so long. It came out, and I really thought, all right, that looks fine. And I was concerned that I wasn't going to get anybody talking to me, because having struggled with the first draft, there was barely anyone there. I just saw numbers, and it was aggravating me. But then all of these people have spoken out, and I was just like, whoa, wow. And Oisin, especially, she was the one who, when it was just there in the T-rated section, and I had some stuff asking, who the heck should the minister be? You know, what branch of church? And she suggested Unitarian. And so I thought, okay, you know, I thought maybe, but she was saying that. So I made some of the changes, and Helena too, and what Oisin and Helena had suggested, what I might add. And Helena was like, well, maybe clothing. And so I added that. And then Oisin was like, you know, I just want to know who's there. And it doesn't have to be a clunky cast of characters. So I was adding a bit more there. I can't even remember exactly what that first chapter was like before I had added those things. I mean, they were just missing, I guess. But yeah, it's just wonderful, the response. I was really surprised. I just didn't expect 3 guest reviews, and Helena I did expect. That was just lovely, because we'd become friends, good friends, you know, by that time. And then Oisin was like, well, this, and all these things. Like, okay. And she's saying, wow, you know, that sounds like him. He completely does seem and sound like Barnabas, like the sweet, concerned, honorable, and loving man that we know from his most positive moments in the show. And that was what I was going for, which is that positive part. And just getting in touch with him. Also, Oisin helping to remind me of the Duprés being quite Catholic, having to incorporate that as well, which actually came up with quite a few reviewers, the reminding of the Catholicism. And other, just somebody appreciating that Barnabas deserving of enjoying the ordinary things in life, be he a vampire or a man. Yeah, ready for the fluff, ready for these people to have a good life. During the wedding itself, it just seemed obvious, okay, Sarah's ghost is accepted and she's going to be around as a flower girl. She was going to be the flower girl in the original 1795 wedding. And of course, that didn't come to be other than what they did themselves in secret. So it made sense with who Sarah is as a character, but it also helped that I went back and I was like, oh yeah, she was going to be the flower girl anyway. That's good. David would be the ring bearer. One thing that I was so pleased about with Oisin's comment that I felt as things were coming forward, what's Sam going to say, giving away his daughter, you know, after all this, everything. Oisin said, I loved Sam's line about neither giving away nor losing his daughter. That was definitely the right thing to say. It completely does sound like Sam as he is in his best moments in the show. When the minister asked, who gives away this bride, her father announced, neither do I lose nor give away my daughter, but present her to make her own choice. Then Barnabas reflects, would André Dupré have said that so many years ago? I think he wouldn't have, which makes this union so much more wondrous than it would have been. And for myself personally, there are a lot of changes and a lot of rearrangements in the wedding ceremony that is almost like a gift to Barnabas, because in many ways, he was a forward thinker. That would help to make it more applicable that he would have to kind of time travel in a box, even though it was really a comatose insanity, after getting through his madness coming into a world that was way more progressive. So he carries a lot of the old times with him, but in many ways, his love for Josette has been very progressive. So with Sam saying this, that there's no losing or giving away of his daughter, but presenting her to make her own choice, it ties in with things that Barnabas wanted in the 1790s as a progressive man. That's how deeply he loves Josette. It's getting away from the kettle, the ownership, the possessiveness, which would be why he'd be ashamed of himself being with, you know, going with Angelique, having that lust thing, because that's more animal, that's more just baser values and desires and stuff, whereas he's longing for going farther and not wanting Josette to be his wife as a form of object. So Sam's presentation, going down the aisle with his daughter to present her, changes. And that, I believe, helps. It's kind of a gift to Barnabas, too. Just have that change in him being in a time period where things have changed that well. So Barnabas has some interesting responses to that, that it's not just the woman who wears the wedding ring. It's now also the man who wears the wedding ring. He's got to figure out. Now he's got two rings to deal with, his onyx one and this new tradition. When it comes to that same thing that a lot of us know in a wedding ceremony of, if anybody has an objection, it was very natural for a lot of the family, knowing who these two people are and knowing their history pretty well, you wait for the silence, you wait for, oh dear, you know, soap opera, something bad's going to happen. It's going to be like Jane Eyre trying to marry Mr. Rochester. Somebody's going to come in and have a fit. And no. So there's silence, and then slow rippling laughter comes in just because, like, oh man, I don't think there's going to be any objection to this. I mean, there's been objection for so long, considering the different centuries of difficulty that this couple has had. And I was told by quite a few people, and they had to come back to tell me, Carolyn was definitely Carolyn when she finally broke the rippling of laughter that was just forming. She said, hardly get the two of them married, for heaven's sake. Definitely, that was Carolyn's job to come through and say that, and it sounded just like her. So then that wedding ends. I didn't have ideas for what would come later as far as the reception goes. That came to me a bit later, and it makes sense that it would be later on that they would remember it together, that you'd get the backstory of what was going on. But I might put a little bit of that in this chapter later. And that's when Barnabas starts to understand there is a telepathy building between them. Now, if he wasn't so high on this just wave of joy that's going through him, he might recognize that some of that telepathy was already there. I had seen that in the show with the characters, especially Kitty calling for him and him trying to rush and find her. So there was that connection that was there. You know, the voiceovers that television will do to try and intimate that, yeah, there is a connection going on. So you just hear a voiceover with possibly an echo in there. So with him, he knows what's going on because she obviously can't speak, "Are you happy now, my love?" Because their lips are together. She's not saying it with her voice. She's saying it with her mind. Also, him recognizing that even though there's sunlight, even though they are out in the day, there is the expressing to the reader that there is vampirism going on. It's been a relief to find the people who wanted it, but also, I believe, a major relief for the people who wanted it to find it, to have it. And that's what there was a lot of celebration going on, even when there were bad things happening with online drama and that kind of thing. But looking back, I'm appreciative for the work, that I can do it, that it came to me, and that people really, really wanted it, really wanted to see it. And that is just that wedding day, which is usually the end of a story. But in this case, it is the beginning. And now, to get to that one, which I thought was going to be a one-shot, The Wedding Night, previously called When I Entered, meaning from those first words Barnabas says. And, yeah, I had the inspiration, and I thought it was just going to be a fleeting thing, but it was playing in my head so often, and helping me to reconnect my marriage together, in other words. It was rough, especially not having anyone to really discuss it with, where I had seen things that I just had visualized, asking the question, well, what happens when you are married at the end of the Pit of Ultimate Dark Shadows? What's going to happen? And I had to put it into words. It was really scary at the time, because I pretty much steered clear of anything resembling erotica as far as my own creation. I gave it a shot in my teens, and I was just unhappy with that. And I was like, eh, I'm not getting to the heart of what I'm looking for here. So with Barnabas, and that was the other thing, you know, when I was like, oh, I got to get this out. I have got to get this out of my system. How the heck am I going to do that? Because I don't want the gross stuff. I don't want the vulgar word usage. I can't handle that. Ah, let Barnabas tell the tale. And that was how it started to become more him in first person. It's like, he's not going to be gross. He's going to just be how he's going to be. And what came out was his mind just being blown and everything just kind of coming forward all at once. And one of the things that helped, because I had already put together, as far as for my own personal listening, episode 13 in the Pit of Ultimate Dark Shadows, A Balancing of the Humors. One of the things that had gotten Maggie and Josette and Barnabas together was this track by Stoa, Conclusio. So when this novel was coming into being, even just for what I presumed was going to be a one-shot and then it was going to be over with, I went back to that group, that musical group, Stoa, S-T-O-A. That helped a lot because Conclusio is more thrill, adventure, whereas their other music is much more romantic, much more subdued, much less percussion instruments. So I focused on that, and that helped a lot. Just to kind of get in touch, you know, a lot of this music that I use for Margaret Josette to Pray to be inspired by has that same resonance as most of Stoa's music. And it was great in this time and place with the internet and things like Pandora and Spotify and that kind of stuff. You can go, well, I like this. Can the machine show me things that are like it? And because of that, and because of me being aware of needing more of that, there are over 500 tracks in my playlist for inspiration to this novel. Also, one of the things that was helping me, that had helped me before, was the novel Lolita. Now, I know that Humbert is an antihero. He is a very pathetic person. at the same time, what I got out of the writing itself and listening to Jeremy Irons perform it, bless his heart, just does a wonderful performance of that book, was a visceral sense and wording of romance. So even though the situation is abominable, the description, I think, is what gets me and a lot of other women about it. It's not so much the situation, it's the language and how romantic some of the language is. But there are other points where Humbert is very smug. And also, it was not the first book that I'd read by that author. I have collected as many of Vladimir Nabokov's novels as I can, including even a stage play that he put together, The Waltz Invention. So it is not just that one book. But I did go back to that to help inspire a way to make sure that nothing vulgar was going to be said. And it really has helped. And I'd used it before. It was the natural thing to go back to Lolita. Now, it may surprise a lot of listeners here who have read what there is of this novel that much of what I would listen to and have listened to in order to create this wasn't so much focusing on Dolores, but her precursor, Annabelle. And that is one of the reasons that it makes sense to go back to Edgar Allan Poe, because Annabelle in the novel Lolita is connected to a certain extent to Annabelle Lee of Edgar Allan Poe. The inspiration for quite a bit of Lolita did come from Edgar Allan Poe. So with chapter 2, The Wedding Night, it is, of course, what one would anticipate, but they have been waiting a long time for this, and it was before I recognized there had been another wedding night in the 1790s. But at the same time, when Barnabas expresses in Josette's bedroom, where they are, that I took all in my hands and possessed her, as she had never let me possess her before. This is still accurate, because this is not just Josette alone, this is Maggie Evans. So, it is different, and it still makes sense. But there are so many things going through his mind. Do I deserve her? But I'm having her. How is it possible? And everything that's just happened between them. And I remember Melissa on the phone saying, trying to follow where his thoughts were going, and him asking in his mind, oh gosh, you know, is this one woman? Is this two women? Is this three women? There was a little bit more added in the second draft, which is that they were trying to be very careful with the wedding dress. It's just like, they're so full of I cannot wait that the dress becomes a worry, but you kind of want to maintain that. Whereas the slip, okay, we can rip that up. That was added later. And it's just very difficult to try and explain this. They're just all over each other. Completely all over each other. He's also paying attention to somehow we are vampires in all of this. It's different than his curse. Understanding that part of it is going to be her feeding on him and her getting off on that. And you might think that it wouldn't make sense, but if you watch some of those episodes in the 1790s where Barnabas has bit Josette, she's looking in the mirror, kind of admiring those bites. She's not sure what's going on. And that's also another reason that at the beginning of chapter 2, there's now added from episode 420, written by Gordon Russell, a quotation. There is nothing, absolutely nothing, that can keep us apart. I don't care about those things that I don't understand. Those things you said about our new life together. I only want to be with you. So we continue on from those words of Josette. The consistent ones, not the ones written way later in the series that I just don't buy. So he expresses what once had cursed us, now altered, had blessed us. He's saying that as violent as some of the moves are, they're very passionate, and that she is taking control a lot of the time. He's not sure what to expect, but Josette is taking control of the situation, and he's just like, yeah, go ahead. No, he also shows himself as being thankful as he's speculating her beauty, that she was pleased, and dearest heavens above, she was pleased with me. So he's extremely grateful that he can give her what she needs. And then, yeah, I was blown away when I visualized this in a questioning what's going to happen, and they're rolling off the bed and just all over the place. I mean, they're just kind of almost tearing the room apart. But somehow none of the candles, you know, or if they do, you know, they go out. It's not a big deal. They're just grabbing at each other, and there might be a little bit of flame that singed their skin, but they're vampires. They can handle it. It's almost like that bit would just be kind of like hot sauce to some of us. A sort of garlic chili, as it were. And yeah, I was very stunned when it kind of became this thing where they were against the wall, and I was like, oh my gosh. But when you think about how long these two lovers have been parted, and now they can finally be together, yeah, it's going to be pretty extreme. But then there's a little allowance of smugness, too, where that perhaps any other Maggie Evans would not have existed if there was not Miss Dupre previously. And he says, of course, is it not like a man to want more than one woman? And is it not easier for one to enjoy the pleasures of two at once like this? And something that's still, it's hard for me to believe that I was able to put this together. But I've seen other things where I'm surprised, oh, did I write that? I mean, even old letters, old emails. And I go, whoa, wow, okay. But what really is just exceptional, I felt that, wow, and what a quotation. Who I was with, both in spirit and in body, and with intensity, loved me. And even if she wanted to chain me down or lacerate me with either a branding or perhaps simply her exquisite cuspids, I cared not. As long as she stroked me, as long as she loved me, as long as she lovingly hurt me with a pain so unyielding as to set my sinews aflame. That was just, whoa. And that, I believe, was also in the first draft of this, when I thought it was just going to be one shot and that was it. You see a little bit of the afterword where they have this very quiet discussion about whispering the details to each other. And that didn't come out till a long time after. That did not show up. I was just sort of going through a lot of motions. There was that. Now, what was wonderful about when I put this up as a one shot, I couldn't find it. You know, I was so worried, I'm just going to get hell for this. I'm going to have, like, all these people offended or whatever, which came much later, of course. But when I couldn't find it, I asked my husband, I'm like, well, I put it up and I can see the statistics for it, but I can't find the darn thing. When he's all, oh, well, look at the filter. Go to the M-rated section. And then I do that and I'm all, look at all these other ones. What the heck did I worry about? What the heck was I worried about? Look at all these other erotic stories. Mostly involving Barnabas, of course. And that's when I found Forever Mine. And I was just blown away. And at some point I got in touch with Helena because I saw that she'd reviewed Forever Mine. I was like, why didn't you tell me about this? You knew I was suffering. And she was like, well, it had crossed my mind. So I was like, oh man. So I'm just blown away and really appreciated that Forever Mine by Angels and Stud was there. And I just felt like, oh, this is good because it means that I'm not nuts. I could have quite a bit less embarrassment about what I've been doing. And all the worry seemed to melt off. I don't have to concern myself with that. But then, of course, what happened? I was trying to put together episode 6 and episode 7 and get the podcasts out there and have them prepared. Because I'd had the cold most of, I think, November of 2013. I couldn't go to any kind of Thanksgiving event because I didn't want to get anybody else sick. And then I was just stuck. I was stuck with this one shot I'd created. I was stuck with all of these other thoughts. I was stuck with staying home. And it didn't stop. I was like, there's more coming out. It's just sort of becoming a cascade of there's more and there's more and there's more. So yeah, a lot of Thanksgiving Day in 2013 was creating the first draft of this novel, and it just would not stop. I was just going, okay, let's do this, let's do that. And trying to come up with the right music to listen to, just trying to find a sense of the pattern of where is this going. And that's why that first draft was just a mess. I mean, I really felt like I was out of control. And then that was also good because, I mean, the cold wasn't that bad. It just was like about a month long. It was more coughing and blowing and just being stuffed up, but it just lasted so long. So that also seemed providential too, where I just started to focus mainly on this. Just all this stuff just kept coming out and kept coming out and kept coming out. And of course, with the reviews for chapter 2, The Wedding Night, it was very nice to see quite a few people take my lead where I said, you know, if all you have to do is say yikes, I heartily agree. And a lot of people did say yikes. Oh, including my auntie. Where she says, yikes indeed, I was struck speechless on my first read through. And when did you last see that happen? Because she's about as talkative as I am. And other things that I would expect from her, that it's a good thing they own the house or they'd never get their damage deposit back, because she'd been through so many things about going through deposits in a lot of places rented. And, oh, one of my favorites is, move over, Angelique Bouchard. We have a new alpha female in Collinsport. Seriously, though, this chapter puts Tim Burton's DS lovemaking scene to shame. And I felt that way, too. I was like, you know, that was pretty extreme and sort of comical for what it was. But then I saw this in my head and brought it to fruition. And yeah. Because there's more going on, you know, more than the visual aspects of it. You know, how each partner's feeling. But yeah, it's a lot of yikes. And Auntie also added, this was a good one, though. I like the contrast that come out when the Austenic, meaning Jane Austen, old-timey diary approach is applied to vampires who like to play rough. So now we have this second draft, which I will get back to here as we move along to chapter 3, which used to be more of a chapter on the end of a flashback, but I decided that, yeah, it made a lot more sense to have that part that when I was rereading The Wedding Nights, this has got to go right after that. That would be okay to do. Moving on to chapter 3, tried to do a read-through twice of this, and added the DS episode 421 lines written by Sam Hall. Josette says, I know that you are dead, but still you are alive. I'm not afraid of death, only of living without you. I'm yours. There's no ceremony that could make me more your wife. And Barnabas answers, yes, you are my wife. Yes, as you were always meant to be. So with chapter 3, what we whispered, they are a bit spent from the exhaustion of the initial consummation of their wedding night. Because they've just had a lot of things to act out and to express. And so they're back on the bed and covered up by some of the bedclothes and not much else. And she expresses, we'll never be done. He wants to know what she means, and she is playfully telling him how she has full control of him, and he is absolutely adoring of that. There were times in the history of Barnabas Collins where he is controlled unwillingly, but in this case, it is just, take me. I am all yours. Which is one of the reasons that I find this romance so incredible. They just adore each other. Utterly, unconditionally. And so there is a little bit more that Josette's looking for in getting his physical attentions. But they're also talking about how strongly they feel towards each other, and how can it just be flesh? And that's one of the amazing things about requited love and romance and struggling to get there. How much appreciation just makes it that much stronger. And that they are kind of in awe of each other, personally, singularly, and also as a couple. That's what a lot of the discussion is about. In this experience, Josette actually helped me to get comfortable with the word husband. She uses it so many times. And for me, for years, I did not like the word. I was like, it sounds like a vacuum cleaner belt, the word husband. But she got me comfortable with it. And the extra physical attention, she basically puts his hand on her heart, where that is. So it is a touching of the memories. And I'm sure there's a few people out there who just are saying, just say it! Well, you say it. Chapter 3 is really just about it being quieter, but still resonating the power in their romance. Just how powerful the romance is. And that how much he adores her for the sake that she would be the one to help him and to help everyone in his family just by being so kind-hearted and generous. But she gently expresses, perhaps I'm not that self-assured. A little bit of self-doubt. And Barnabas also focuses on the fact that she has not taken the name Collins. Because she has been so many women, she takes a new name, but it's a blend of Josette Dupré and Maggie Evans. And that's one of the reasons that throughout the novel, people just call her by all these different things. They will still call her Maggie Evans, even though she's married. She's just too different to bother with convention. And people are comfortable with the different variations of her name. And one of the great reasons that it's just called Margaret Chausette Dupré. Originally, I just called it Margaret Dupré. Then I realized you put Chausette in there to make sure that you know this is who she is. And so he's doing as she asked. And he's also reflecting what she wants now that they are officially married. And the evidence and how this came into being where there were terrible circumstances. He kidnapped her, but then her own ghost is calling out to her, as well as the ghost of his sister, Sarah. And within herself, being kind of separated from all those past lives and disconnected, she was calling out to herself. And so they make love for a second time. One would have thought once would be enough, but well, there's a little intermission where they are having their own personal reflections and a lot of discussion, and then continuing on in a much slower, calmer fashion. So it feels way less like an attack. Then, of course, at the end, there is this thing that they're both very aware of, and he strokes her
midline
with his hand to kind of ask the question. And she says, yes, I feel that as well. I feel it as well. So they're both feeling that between the kissing of the lips and down to the nether regions, it's all there. That's all warm and melting and love and on this sort of spiritual level, so to speak. And that they are both feeling that connection. That they're both having that same sensation and have to say out loud, I love you. Oh, and one of the lovely things, because they were talking about their past together, and I kind of remember who this guest was. She said, keeps getting better. I just know she's going to make him pay, though. But let's be honest, he deserves it. Because it's all great. That's basically what she's saying. It's all great now, but at some point, she's going to punish him back for the other things. I believe Melissa also mentioned, as beautiful as it is, there's a darkness, which is like the previous reviewer I had mentioned, that he loves her so deeply and wants to atone for all the pain he's caused her as Chausette and her other reincarnations. But she loves Barnabas intensely, and he her, and we sense that their journey of mutual healing and contrition is only starting. Of course, we will root for our favorite couple every step of the way. And what was also very nice that I did not expect back in April 2014, Oisin actually pointed out that it was beautiful, both the physical aspects and the non-physical. And I love the line about her own ghost calling to her. It's really good. Just a little bit. It didn't have to be a lot. And now we get to chapter 4, which I have longstanding had troubles with, especially the first draft. I was like, because she's complicated. I'm complicated. But me figuring out Chausette, I mean, that's been a struggle. Especially when I'm fast-forwarding to the end result in the relief series. She was just coming at me all at once, and I was like, I don't even know, like, what she wants to say exactly, and just know she's, like, incredibly boisterous with how she feels about this guy. And, of course, tapping into that is a little troubling for me because, as I've said on many occasions, I'm not in love with him. So, I remember even telling Oisin over the phone, why? You know, all these people just going gaga over Barnabas Collins. I'm like, why would you want him? I see it a little bit, though. I do see the allure, like, what's going on there. But, of course, as some of you know, I have a bit more of a preference for the boyish, and Barnabas is rarely, if ever, boyish. So, with Chapter 4, Chausette speaks, it was really nice. I knew the quote of Hell Hath No Fury, but I went to make sure that it was quoted correctly from William Congreve's The Morning Bride, 1697. Heaven has no rage, like love to hatred turned, nor hell a fury, like a woman scorned. That's the actual quote. I was trying to come up with something that would equate to how Chausette felt finally being reunited with Barnabas, and Helena helped me with that. That she proposed paradise over heaven, so it became paradise has no glory, like a woman satisfied. I thanked her for that in my notes, as it really did help a lot. So initially, it was just Josette going all over the place. She's like, oh, he pleases me so much. And I was like, can you tone it down? Can you tone it down a little bit? And hopefully when I do a third draft of this chapter, it'll be even more subtle. It won't be so blatant. But I was really happy to get something different on the second draft of the chapter. Even the first draft, I kept on trying to switch it around. That it is her speaking. That's the point to say, hey, the narrator is now going to switch. It's going to be the bride. And because she is Maggie Evans, one of the first things that, you know, waking her up, not wanting to be idle, oh, I got to go to work. I got to dig. That is where her head's at, getting up in the morning of starting my day, having it be organized and having me get to my responsibilities. And Barnabas is there to remind her, hey, oh, no, you're not going anywhere. You belong right here. There's no rushing. He thought of going for a walk, but he refused to leave her. And she notices that all the things that they, in their wild passion, had strewn about the room, he picked them up. And he had time to pick them up because he wanted to just watch her sleep. And she's wondering why he didn't stay in bed. And he said, I did for an hour or so. And there were lovely things that happened during that time as well that you may not have been conscious of. So they kind of tease each other. And when he explains what time it is, because they're starting to go through the motions of switching hours because of this vampirism that they now share. She's waking up later. She's thinking, I got to get up. And he interrupts her, then hurry on to the day, rush off to work, forget what happened yesterday, which was the wedding and the consummation of the wedding. So he's basically teasing her and she sort of calms down and that it's their honeymoon that's begun. And he says, but we haven't gone anywhere. And she says, but we've moved forward in time. What better getaway is that? And he just keeps complimenting her because he's just in adoration. And she's just saying, stop complimenting me. Just kiss me. So then it goes into the stuff that I really would like to get better pace. But Helena assured me, oh, it looks fine. You know, there's no problem. She's just sort of reflecting her own story and presenting that to potential readers. And yeah, there is stuff in there where she just is kind of going up and down. There's so much stuff going on in her mind. It's just going back and forth like that. And for now, that's the best that I could do because we have three incarnations, three lifetimes, and she's just trying to almost explain herself to herself in certain ways. And also giving a little bit of adoration in the direction of Willie Loomis. I think that was a bit intentional of understanding that, hey, he's not out of the equation as far as being a friend, and he hasn't wandered off or anything, and they appreciate his kindness, his friendship, and his help. Of course, at the end of chapter 4, there's a little bit of information as to what I was searching for in even asking the what-if question, and then suddenly I'm seeing the wedding night, is that afterward, what would they say to each other? Barnabas tells Maggie, if my wealth can make any of the hardships you've experienced easier, it's at your disposal. And she's surprised. How can you do that? Simply giving me all of what you own, like that. And he answers, well, you've already given me yourself. So, clothes off, it's rather M-rated and erotic, but if you have that with the clothes on, it's an observation of a marriage vow. And that was all I was shooting for initially. But it has been a tough case this chapter. For that, it gets pretty good discussion. And one of the reasons there is so much discussion over the years for the first chapters of Margaret's Letter to Prey, that's where people are starting. So they're excited, but after a while, they either stop reading or they read without thinking they need to say anymore. They just either get lost in it or, oh my gosh. Yeah, and they basically reflected the discussion. It was just, yeah, this is her just being happy, noticing, expressing herself. And Auntie actually pointed this out. I can totally see her getting up before he did, sneaking a peek at his journal, stifling her giggles, and going back to sleep. Is that how she knows now what he wrote last night, or is it a telepathic thing? Now, I'm not sure when they would be writing this stuff, but for the time being, it's a telepathic thing. Just getting mind waves and that kind of thing. That's a good thing to point out, all the lonely waiting. Yeah, she pointed out some stuff that I could definitely use, which is nice, just because I do take her a lot more seriously than gobs of strangers. And again, that's why dialogue, knowing the other person that you're talking to, is very helpful. because you can kind of interpret how they express themselves in a review or a comment if you know who they are already. So that is a good thing. I only wanted to touch lightly on chapter 4. And now we come to the final installment for this podcast, chapter 5, which is called Sharing the Past, the Present, and the Future. By this time, I was getting enough support, so I felt more at ease with a lot of this stuff, and thank you all, people who reviewed up to that point, and talked to me about it too, when things weren't as crazy. Some of the private messaging on those sites did work, so yeah, that helped, because it was just going to be the broken bed chapter again for chapter 5, and then this other stuff started coming out. Because there was enough support and understanding and interest, for sure. You know, there was a feeling of celebration about this novel and me bringing it back, and that helped. So, for a lot of you that were supportive at the time, even before things started going really bad with how the technology started changing us too much, there was a lot of stress at the time, too, but the support, I was not getting sleep, and when I got the support, the sleep started to come back. Because I was just so much in a panic of not being understand why people couldn't talk about what there was. And so, thank you. You know, at the time, it's changed, of course, by now, 2019. But at the time, yeah, there was a feeling that we're going to be fine, at least for a little while. Chapter 5, we're going back to Barnabas narrating. And at first, it sort of starts to what was happening that second evening. But then we get to a prior installment before that second evening, to the point I'm not even sure I remember how it happened, how that sixth chapter just came out, and how it was described and all that, because I'm so ingrained in chapter 5 moving to chapter 6, and there was a reason they were rushing back to the old house. But for chapter 5, it's the day out. It's the first day out as a married couple. There is that post-wedding dress that quite a few brides have. Sometimes they wear it as they're going off to the honeymoon, but in this case, honeymoon started with the wedding dress being removed. And so then she's got her first day out as a married woman dress. And Barnabas helps her into that. And that is something that he finds almost equally as exciting as removing clothing, is helping her out with that. And by this time, the vanity, well, it shows that's vanity. Yes, this is her. And she's saying about the next day dress that she'd been looking forward to wearing it, and don't destroy this dress. Because there was a time, I want to say late 60s, but definitely somewhere in the 70s, where there was a set of patterns that resembled old style clothing. It was just this trend that was going on at the time. So I felt it was very easy to have Maggie pick this out, and that she looks forward to it because it's a blend of old and new. Wearing this dress. And he says, I've noticed that. Everyone seems so underdressed to me, but once in a while there are designs that are akin to what we knew. And she says, thank you. And he wonders why. And she says, for saying we, meaning he is recognizing she is Josette, even if it's a reincarnation of Josette. And he is also thankful for that, that he's not fooling himself anymore. That she knows his questions, but better still, she has the answers to them. So we go on a little bit about the dress. She says that she's happy not living at the great house of Collinwood, because she prefers to see it at a distance, that it's a nice view. And there are some bad memories there from her two previous lives. And how there were some good memories. And the good memories are whenever she was in whatever life it was, in his arms, or Sarah playing outside, or even coming to find me again when things were so horrible between us. Now, that could mean either her as Maggie, or her as Josette. That could be either one. So I felt like just making it kind of a general description was fine. As they're out for their walk, that's what they talk about. She also talks about the regression therapy a little bit. It was like this question of who is Josette, and there was this kind of vacuum surging towards her. And then these memories come back, and the answer is, she's me. And so he points out how painful that sounds, but that basically she says it was necessary for all the reasons that for herself and for the two of them. And they actually visit Eagle Hill Cemetery together and look through the mausoleum, and she takes a nod at Naomi Collins. Oh, at some point, yeah, she kind of tests him with wanting a little bit of his blood and just he being kind of awkward and uncomfortable with that. But at the same time, there's sort of a rush of pleasure that he's having with it, too. And part of that was to get him more comfortable. Like, this is our relationship now. This is something that had to come for the sake that we need the time together. And it's one of those things. You know, you had this curse, and now we are using it as a blessing to have all that time that we lost over the centuries. And they also begin to notice the telepathy getting a little bit stronger, rather than perhaps in the series where it's a moment of stress and that's when a telepathic connection happens. Now it's becoming more of a basic communication. That was helpful for me to figure out in the first draft of this, is that that would naturally happen. So with Chapter 5, we have that starting to get stronger, as we saw that with the wedding day, when they kissed at the end of the actual wedding. And I'm sure it will be prevalent in the pit at some point. There is also the little something, you know, when they're visiting Josette's grave, and Maggie is talking about how grateful she is not to be down there again, but he kisses her hand, and there's a little bit of a Morticia joke of someday go up the arm, like Gomez does. Barnabas reflects on that as all three women's humor blending together, too, and that it makes a lot of sense because they are one glorious woman after all. And one thing that Maggie also notices as they're walking around, they see people from afar, and one couple is Carolyn and Tony. And it's something very Josette, as well as Maggie and possibly Kitty, it's just being so happy and wanting to know that other people could achieve that same kind of happiness. Just wanting that, wishing for it. And this was a little bit of the thought of, if they wanted to write all this down and share it, why? Why would they want to? Because it might help someone else to find happiness, to understand how they achieved it together. That was also a key little point. And she also points out to him, trying to explain it just through the dialogue, that material possessions are supposed to enhance life, not control us. Yeah, there's sometimes you get excited about a game or a book or a movie, but you always want to share it with somebody. And focusing on the purpose, the reason that we want friendship, the reason that we want to have some of those material possessions, because they might grow a richer bond with another person, but then also understanding that the friendships and the relationships in life should be the more important thing overall, not the material possessions, and to appreciate moments that we share together. That was something that, in the author's note at the end, I asked, you know, what did you get out of that? And I'm still curious, even though there's plenty enough reviews for chapters 1-5. It just depends on if you want to talk about it. I'm more than happy to do so. Then something that I kind of learned in creating this is that, you know, I thought it was going to be a one-shot. And then as I reread that, what I thought was the one-shot, it started to just grow and there was more and more. And that's what they talk about also, Maggie points out. If we relive some of this wonderful experience together, it's going to inspire us to have more of the same and then write that down and then kind of just keep on going. And I found that to be quite true as far as making a creation and refeeding it into my psyche and then realizing, okay, there's changes that I can make. And there's also just the joy of seeing all these characters work everything out. And even the problems are kind of funny, too. So then there's the bench that they find near the cliffs, and they just enjoy looking at the ocean together, knowing that the light is starting to fade. And also, she squeezes his hand. One thing that really touched me about the bench, them sitting on the bench, was being so close, just appreciating the moment, and them being content for a spell. She rests her head on his shoulder, and he kisses the top of her head. That is just marvelous. And really cute when she grips his hand, and he's asking, why did you do that? If there was any reason for it. And she says, I'm thinking about last night. And he asks which part, and it was the second. Because, I mean, they've just exploded with their love. So he has to ask, you aren't shy, are you? And she says that she's surprised, but she kind of curls her fingers to her mouth in a blushing manner. And it really, I found that really, really cute, really sweet and adorable. And I didn't expect it. You know, it's coming out of me. It's coming out of my fingers and my head and stuff. But, I mean, like I said, they're not my characters. So I just say, what if, and then it kind of just unfolds right in front of me. Then they kiss, and he touches her face, and it is in a certain way that she recalls, which I might have made up, but wouldn't be unlike him, sort of using the back of his hand to graze her face really gently. And she has just got this moment of wonder. Has any fondness been as pure as what you and I share? And he blinks. At times, some may consider it rather brusque, but I don't. You kind of hear him say that. And because there's just, you know, there's that thing. Okay, now that urge and that hunger is sort of growing yet again. And as they pull away from each other, she asks, it's time to go back, isn't it? He says, without a doubt, because they're going, okay, it's coming back. And that would end up being the reason that we have the next chapter, chapter 6. So add the reviews before we wrap up the chapter 5 here with the thoughts given for chapter 5. Elena expected them to get down and dirty in the mausoleum, but that didn't happen. She did hit on the journal writings as being resourceful for future possibly troubled couples. She found it interesting and progressive of Maggie to point it out. And now that's true. Of course, she says, what's next? I think because she kind of remembered the old ones. Like, well, you know what's coming up. Yeah, it was really coming strong. And Myrrh was still reviewing in 2014. And she was saying, like, don't stop. You know, I don't want to leave the reader hanging. She's just trying to encourage me because she wanted more too, real bad. And that she had a certain peace brought to her psyche, knowing that Barnabas and Josette / Maggie can experience some of the things that so many of us take for granted. The simple things that make one's life complete. That was really good. Another reviewer was that it was tender, sweet, romantic. Oh, so poignant to channel the Josette and Barnabas that should have been those who will never be separated by time or what life has dealt them. Bravo. That's good. Yeah, it was good to get the discussion back then. And then even later, Melissa stepped in to discuss certain things that she appreciated, such as Barnabas acknowledging that it was selfish for him at any point to use the reanimation aspect back in the 1790s, and to be able to apologize for it, too. And that the chapter itself, chapter 5, is that they're cleansing, purging, and putting all their suffering behind them. That they are no longer prisoners of that pain, and that their love is triumphant. Then Auntie came in last year and enjoyed it too, walking around making peace with all the history of Collinwood and the Collins family in a literal personal way that would be beyond the reach of anyone who'd only lived a single life of the standard 70 and 10. And then she definitely noticed the nod to Morticia that Maggie was giving. So, oh yeah, it was such a delight to go through this again. Hopefully some of y'all need it as much as I did. I hope I did a good enough job with this. Hopefully I can finish it and have it out before Valentine's Day. So one by one, something here and there to keep you going. Otherwise, I'm just trying to make a schedule for myself and keep to that schedule the best I can. Everything in moderation, including moderation. Being helpful to friends who I want to attend to. Trying to get back to the chapters that I have to finish for LibriVox, and also my letters. Thank you very much, all the pen friends who stayed in touch and stay in touch. And yeah, getting me out of the madness. I just needed a lot of help. And I'm very willing to help other people and be the moral support that you need too. It's all symbiotic. And that's another thing that's very important about this marriage novel, is that some of the best relationships, it comes to being symbiotic, to know that everybody needs their me time, but what love is caring for the person, making sure that their needs are met, not being too possessive, if possessive at all. Yeah. And I am working on the script for 21, as well as very slowly the audio for 20. There's a lot of problems with it. And that is about it. I hope all of you are doing well. And if you have a sweetheart, I hope you're very, very happy. Take care.